Greetings and salutations, everyone, and welcome to another episode of my podcast. I'm Harold C. Connolly, Jr., an explorer of space, time, and the human experience. And I do so in very specific ways. I do so as being founding chair and professor of the Department of Geology at Rowan University in Glassboro, New Jersey. And I do so by being co-investigator and the mission sample scientist on OSIRIS-REx, which is NASA's New Frontiers 3 asteroid sample return mission. And today I'm coming to you once again from the Drake Building of the University of Arizona, which is the heart of the OSIRIS-REx mission. And today I am very pleased to be here with my friend and colleague, Dr. Ellen Howe, who is an interdisciplinary scientist on the mission, who is a remote sensor spectroscopist. Ellen, thank you for joining me.
Thank you.
And tell us what your role is on the mission. What is your passion, and what do you actually work on with remote sensing?
So my scientific experience has mostly been in telescopic observations of asteroids, looking at them from the ground, in the visible, in the near infrared, for the last 25 years. And so this was my first chance to be part of a spacecraft mission and look at an asteroid close up from a spacecraft, in the same way that we've been doing from the ground, except of course from the ground they're never more than a point of light. You don't get the spatial resolution to see what the surface looks like, and so that's very exciting. And the spectrometers on the OSIRIS-REx spacecraft are very well designed to cover the whole visible near infrared and even far infrared, more comprehensive coverage than any other mission that has flown to an asteroid. So that's very exciting.
Yes, it is very exciting, and we're on the approach to the asteroid.
Yes, very soon.
And we get there on the 3rd of December, right? Or 2nd of December.
Well, but we get our first spectra of Bennu, it'll still be of the whole hemisphere that we see, but we'll get the first spectrum from the spacecraft November 2nd and 3rd.
That's right.
Oh, so that's exciting. The day that's marked on my calendar.
Right. So quickly tell the audience, in a very basic way, what the spectrometers actually do and what you're looking for with that data.
Okay, well, the mission is all aimed at finding a good place to take a sample and return to the Earth, of course. But in order to understand what that sample means, and we have to really know where it comes from, and to understand
the geologic context, right?
That the asteroid as a whole, and to find the best place to choose the sample from. And so part of the mission ahead of time is to do the best job that we can to understand to map the whole surface, to get composition of the whole surface, to get its thermal properties, to get its to take images of the surface, to look at the surface texture, and all of that stuff. And all of that feeds into choosing the best place to collect the sample, and then understanding that sample in terms of when it gets back to the Earth, we can take it apart and look at every atom in it. But in order to really understand it, we have to understand the asteroid Bennu also.
Right. And we have the great pleasure of being able to ground truth the remote sensing data by bringing the sample back.
Yes, and we have already done that with the Hayabusa mission to Itokawa, and they didn't get as much sample as they had hoped, but they did get some, and those samples have been very helpful in making the connection between asteroids as we thought we have understood them from telescopic data over the last several decades. And a lot of our ideas were right. Turns out that was great to find out.
Right.
But Bennu is a very different kind of asteroid, and this will be a very important connection.
Yeah, that's a good point to bring up, because the remote sensing data from Itokawa compared with the laboratory data, compared with the samples, matched.
Yes.
Which gives us one data point that the remote sensing essentially knows what it's seeing.
Right. Well, I mean, we have all these meteorites, and we don't often know exactly where they came from, but we can make those connections with the remote sensing data, and there's been a lot of debate on that over the years, and we've had some ideas, and some of those were borne out with the Itokawa data. Ordinary chondrites we thought were like these things, but that was a real good confirmation, and this will be the other piece of that puzzle with the carbonaceous chondrites, the dark meteorites, which aren't as abundant, but maybe that's just because they don't survive to the ground.
Right.
We certainly have a lot of them, that we know there's a diversity. We don't know which ones, if any of them, will be a good match for what Bennu
is. We don't. That's right.
And that'll be the really exciting thing. In fact, I think the most exciting result might be that Bennu turns out to not match any of our meteorites.
Yeah, I agree.
And it's a totally different thing.
I agree,
But whatever it turns out to be, we're going to learn a lot from it.
Oh, absolutely. We're learning a lot already.
Yes.
I mean,
We'll start soon.
Well, no, we have been, because we've been preparing to get to the asteroid, and it has, because of it being our target, we have done many, many things that scientifically and engineering-wise we would never have done unless we were going there.
Yes, that's certainly true.
Right.
A lot of resources have gone towards preparing for this mission, and that's all turning up, you know, fantastic results about understanding asteroids.
What is one of the major challenges of being a remote sensor and working on a space mission, that, especially one that's as big as OSIRIS-REx?
Well,
if there is any.
It's there certainly are plenty of challenges. No shortage there. It's been a very different experience for me, just because I haven't worked on a big coordinated project like this before, and I've been more... I mean, I've worked in big groups, but not on... It's been more, you know, the data collection is more just on me at the telescope.
Right.
Looking at a selection of objects and having my own science goals.
Right.
I haven't really been part of, you know, a big coordinated mission like this. There's a lot of different kinds of challenges. A lot of it has been... really fun. A lot of it has been there's also a lot of overlying bureaucracy and endless telecons and meetings, and
that's
frustrating.
That's a good point, actually.
But it's a learning experience, and it's a lot of it has been very positive too.
Sure, of course. And as scientists, we tend to want to be and need to be creative. And for a lot of us, that means not a lot of logistical constraints on us. But when you're involved in something like a space mission, you do have to go to telecons. And you do have to, you know, dial into things that maybe you really don't want to that day for some reason. But you have to, you know.
Right.
And that's a key point. Yeah.
Well, and I think people don't always appreciate that. You know, science is not really a prescribed recipe of I do this and I do that and I do this and I get to this goal. It's a creative process.
Right.
And often you start in a direction and you think you know how it's going to go, but you look at the data and say, wait, that wasn't what I expected to see. Why is that happening? What's going on? And you end up with problems to solve, and that's what's fun. But when you have a problem that crops up that you didn't understand, you want to go and pursue it. And you didn't have, you know, the mission has a lot more scheduled activities that have to happen at a time, and I have to do this and I have to do that.
Right.
And you can't just pursue the problem when it comes up to your heart's content, as I was able to do before. So that's
been
a big adjustment.
Yeah, and that's a good point. And especially once we start collecting considerable amount of data at the asteroid, it's the process of collecting that data is twofold. One, as you mentioned earlier, it is to support determining a site to collect the sample first and primary. After that, there'll be a lot of time for longer term science to go off and be creative in a way that is not necessarily schedule oriented.
Right. Well, at least we hope.
Well, we hope. Right. exactly. Well, there'll be papers that come out all along, right? We'll be producing the short-term science papers in reference to when we're collecting data at the asteroid in support of sample site collection and sample site determination, but then there will be a lot more science that has to be done afterwards, because there's just not enough time to do all that science right then when we're building the maps to create an idea or validate an idea where we want to go for site, exactly. Site collection, right? So, if I remember right, you're a geologist originally?
Well, more of an astronomer. I was in geophysics, but planetary science.
Right. Okay, that's it.
As an undergrad, and then took a little detour into doing Earth remote sensing, but then came back to astronomy. I worked at Arecibo Observatory for 15 years.
That's right.
Radar observations of near-Earth asteroids primarily, right. But also some radio astronomy of comets. So mostly I've been at the telescope side of planetary science, studying solar system objects at various different wavelengths.
Right. I think that's actually when I got to know you a little bit better. It was when we went to Japan together, and you were still at Arecibo then, and we had some major discussions over many a meal about the radar observing of asteroids. Why is radar observing of asteroids so important?
Radar is a unique way of studying near-Earth asteroids. When an object comes close enough that you can send a radar signal and get enough of an echo back, and for Arecibo, which is a very large dish, typically that's about 0.06 AU, something like 10 times the distance, 30 times the distance to the moon.
Mm-hmm.
I used to know these numbers.
That's what happens, learning new things now.
But the unique capability that radar gives you is that you can spatially resolve features on the asteroid from the ground, and you can't generally do that optically. Now, occasionally you can get something, if an object comes close enough with adaptive optics, you can maybe get a little bit of the shape of it. But radar has this incredible precision something like 10 to the 15, so that you can resolve even things that are millions of miles away. You can get down to 7.5 meter resolution, 3.5 meter now with Goldstone. Right. So there's only two radar facilities on Earth, and Arecibo is 20 times more sensitive than the one at Goldstone, although Goldstone has, they have complementary capabilities. So the two systems really working together form a very comprehensive network,
right.
but there are only two of them, right. And so
currently,
it's, well, there aren't really plans to build more. So,
I thought there was one in China. No.
Well, there is a radio telescope in China, but it has no radar capability and is not intended to.
I see. Okay.
And it does not function at a high enough frequency to even receive the radar echoes that either Arecibo or Goldstone sends now.
Mm.
And so it's not clear if it was originally intended to operate at higher frequency, but there are technical difficulties with that. So it doesn't currently, and I don't know if they
plans. I just misunderstood. But if we go back to your discussion about the understanding the shape of asteroids through radar observations versus, say, you know, light curve or light observations, right? So we have two data points from missions that feed into that equation, right?
Well, more than two.
More than two, but at least recently two. So we have what was known about asteroid Lugu before Hayabusa 2 approached, which wasn't from radar.
We never were able to do radar of Ryugu.
Right.
We had it on the schedule, and the Arecibo system unfortunately wasn't working during the time that we would have had to do it. And so we did have extensive observations of Bennu,
mm-hmm.
And that was one of the reasons it was chosen as
right.
the target
Right, but I guess my point I want to make is that luckily the light curve observations of Rugu and the model shape model was generated from that was more or less similar because it's top
shape. Well, no, it was actually quite a ways off.
Was it really?
Yeah. In fact, that was one of the first things I looked at was when the pictures came back, I said, wow, that doesn't look anything like the initial shape model. I wonder what happened. And I looked, and it turns out the pole was way off. And that's one of the things that's not often appreciated in radar shape modeling is that you get an idea of the features on the asteroid, but often it really depends on the geometry and how much coverage you have, how good a shape model you can get. And It's tied in with knowing where the rotation pole is, and the ambiguities in the data are such that you can be fooled if you don't have very complete coverage. And so it turns out that because we didn't have the radar observations, we had a light curve and an idea of where the pole was, but the idea was quite a ways off. And so the initial shape model was very asymmetric, north to south, and the actual object is very symmetric.
Right, it is quite symmetric, yeah.
And so, but the mission, as they were getting close and started to get resolved images, they were able to generate a shape model, even starting with a pole that was way off from where it actually was. They were able to correct for that and got a very good shape model very quickly. And so that whole process seems to be very robust, even if your initial estimate is way off, which is good to know.
Oh, okay. Well, our Japanese colleagues are quite good at what they do.
Yes. Well, and yeah. our own OLA team was also working on those same data.
That's right. Yeah.
Together
Olivier
with them
and company. And
Olivier said that within a couple of days, the whole model just locked right in, and they got a great chance to test all of their techniques.
So. Right. Right. But Rosetta did have a big surprise when it got to its target.
Yes. Well, comets are a whole different thing. We don't have very many opportunities to get radar on comets, and that's something that I've also been working on.
But okay.
We have now, in 30 years, we've managed to get 14 of them. And this is compared to about 700 asteroids.
Yeah, okay. So huge difference. Huge difference. Yeah, okay.
So comets just don't come close enough to the Earth very often to give us that opportunity. But yes, the shape of the Rosetta nucleus target was extremely non-spherical and very difficult to operate a spacecraft around.
Yeah, right.
Yes, when we first saw those, our own engineers said, "Oh my God, if Benny was like that," and we had to tell them,
"No, we
have radar of it. We know
exactly.
It doesn't look like that." And in fact, we went and did a fun exercise of taking the Rosetta shape model of CG and simulating radar of it. I mean, if we know what the shape is, we can say, if we looked at it, what would it look like?
Okay.
And we generated some radar images and said, look, see, it would look so weird, we would know this looks so different than the radar images of Bennu, and so it doesn't look like that. We're safe.
So since I did my last podcast with Josh Emery, actually, in the other room, we've seen several more images of Rugu than what we had at that time back in August. When you see these beautiful images coming from asteroid Rugu, from Hayabusa 2, what goes through your mind?
Well, when I first saw the first ones, I thought, wow, that looks a lot like what we think Bennu looks like. It's bigger, but... And then as we were getting closer, and I haven't maybe seen the very latest ones, but it has got huge blocks all over it. And I thought, oh boy.
Massive
if
blocks.
If Bennu looks like that, we are in trouble. Now, we did have...
Well, we're challenged, for sure.
we did an experiment. I had a summer student that looked at Bennu a few years ago and did a simulation of if... Because we saw a lump on Bennu. We think we saw in the radar, there's a boulder.
Right, there's a boulder.
There's like a 10 meter, 15 meter boulder-ish.
Right.
And we spent a lot of time on the radar imagery to decide exactly where that boulder was. It turns out that its location was key to constraining the shape model. But we only saw one. And we thought, well, is that just because it happened to be in a really good spot where we would see it? Or would we have seen a boulder that size anywhere? And we can do that experiment. We can make, we can take the shape model and we can simulate boulders other places and then do a synthetic, create a radar image and say, would we have seen it or not? And so we had a student go through and do that and put boulders both bigger and smaller over the surface. And what he found was that if there were boulders that size anywhere on the surface, except maybe right up near the pole, we would have seen them. And so it wasn't just in a special place. They were visible anywhere they happened to appear. And so that probably means there aren't a lot more big blocks like that.
Right.
But that if he also found that if you make them half that size, if you make them 5 meters or 10 meters, then there could be plenty of those that we wouldn't have seen.
Oh,
and so there, there can be big enough blocks that they may cause us some headaches, but there probably aren't a lot more very big ones, 20 meters in size. And
right.
So depending on what the, you know, you expect there to be more and more as you go to smaller sizes,
right.
But maybe it won't be quite as rough and rocky.
Well,
as
that's
usual,
one of the things that's one of the things I did with one of the early pictures when there was a scale bar with the first one that had a scale bar with the surface well resolved. I just sat there on my desk and just was measuring boulders. I was like, oh my God, this thing is huge.
Uh-oh.
Oh my God, this one's huge. Oh my God, this one is huge. Wait, this is small. Let me see this one. No, it's not. It's as big as a Volkswagen.
Yeah, there's not a lot of space between them to squeeze in and go sample the surface.
No,
so that
no.
could be a challenge.
Yeah, it's definitely a challenge for... Yeah. Also in Hayabusa too, so there's no question about it.
Now, the spectrum of Ryugu is similar but not identical to that of Bennu, and so the material properties could be different enough that the surface texture could be quite different.
Could respond differently, correct.
We'll see soon enough. And we know there are lots of different kinds of these dark asteroids out there. And they have had all different histories. They're all individuals. And that's part of why it's great to have these two missions going to two different objects so close together, that we can do those comparisons.
That's a very good point, yes. And it's a very complementary attitude the two teams have towards each other's missions. And very cooperative
very
and
good.
Culturally, we're learning a lot from each other. And being on both of the missions has been, I have to say, one of the major career highlights so far from my life. That's
for
sure.
You've seen both of them from the inside.
Yep.
That's
from early on as well. Even early on in the communications between the two, which I was part of establishing.
Oh, great.
Myself and Shogo and Dante and a few other people like Masaki and stuff. It's been really, really rewarding and pleasant. I mean, we were there together in Japan too, so you know the Hayabusa symposium, which was a lot of fun.
Yeah, it was.
So, besides being a scientist and everything else, a little bit of personal information, you have a life partner, you have a family, you've found time for all these wonderful things.
Well, I wish I could find more time. I always feel like I have too many things to juggle and don't have enough time to devote to any one of them to do as good a job as I'd like to. That's a constant source of frustration.
I think many of us go through that.
I certainly don't regret trying to, a lot of people in science find that in order to really be competitive and do as much science as they want to do, they have to give something up. And there was somebody on a panel early on, I remember, saying, okay, there's three parts of life. You can have a career, you can have a life, do hobbies or whatever, or you can have children, have a family of some description. And you can have any two of those three, but you can't have all of them. And that may be a little extreme, but I think you can feel like you can do a very good job of two of them. But if you're trying to do all three, which I foolishly got into my head that I could, I do always feel like I'm shortchanging somebody.
Oh,
and that is hard.
Well, my grandfather, I don't have a family, but my grandfather always told me that a busy person finds a time to do the things that they want to do. And I think there is some truth to that.
Well, I think there are people who are better organized than I am, but there is always
seems
something.
Seems like you've accomplished a lot, so you're not that badly organized.
Well, there's a lot of things I've wished I could do that have fallen by the wayside.
Okay.
And, maybe everybody has that.
I think everybody has
to some extent.
Yeah,
but, I do feel like I would have liked to have spent more time with my kids when they were smaller. They're mostly grown now, but that doesn't mean they don't still demand parts of your time.
Of course.
And, there are things in my career that I have had to choose not to do because I had too many other things going.
Right.
And,
right.
There's always something that you can't really fit in. And then, of course, time for yourself kind of is the first thing to go. So.
I suppose that's true. Yeah. There's not always that rest time period. Yeah, I can believe that. Sure. Well, I mean, you've come sort of full circle in life, really, in some ways, in the sense that, you know, you spent time here before when you were younger.
I was in grad school here at U of A, right. Yes, and then
you spread your wings, wound up in Puerto Rico for many, many years, and then back to Arizona
again. Back to Arizona. It's so nice to be back in Tucson.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, and it's certainly a wonderful opportunity that you were able to take advantage of to come and work on OSIRIS-REx and new challenges. And is there something you want to add? You're also obviously a woman in science.
I've
interviewed several women at this point in science.
It would be nice to say, gee, you know, it's gotten so much better for women in science than it was 20 years ago, but I think I can't really say that.
Okay.
My daughter is now also just about to graduate from college as a woman in science, and you know, I would really like to think that the opportunities available to her are a lot broader than what was available to me, but I'm not sure it's true.
Hmm.
Some things have improved, some things have changed, but there's a lot of other things that I thought when I was starting out, you know, oh gee, things are getting so much better, so much faster. Pretty soon no one will care if you're a woman or a man or anything about you or the color of your skin or anything that you believe. And that's just not true. A lot of those barriers aren't nearly as blatant as they were, but they're still there.
That's a very important point, and I don't know if it's in part because I'm a gay man, you know, openly out, when I sit on certain kinds of meetings, I notice this sort of negative viewpoint that is actually projected in subtle forms of speech and action, not overtly anymore for the most part. And that becomes very complicated. And I get my own knickers in a twist, so to speak, about it. It's like, and one particular thing, just an example, I was running this particular kind of meeting and wound up that I started calling the female members of this group Dr. such and such, Dr. such and such, to remind some of the people on the panel that these are the experts. Point well made.
You know, getting treated as if your opinion matters, treated as being listened to. I still find I can say the same words as some of my male colleagues and they just aren't heard.
Yeah.
And they're not heard the same way. And, you know, for a while I was very frustrated with the notion of, oh, well, women just aren't asking right. You know, you aren't acting the way that a man would do. You're not asking for a raise. How do you expect to get one if you don't ask? And how do you expect to be, if you're not aggressive enough, if you don't lean in, you know, all of that, those kinds of things? A lot of that is blaming the victim. It's like, I'm not doing something right, and it's your own fault.
Yeah.
And finally, I think we're coming back around to say, look, it's not your fault. This is just trying to deflect the blame. No, the system has to change, and that's a very slow process. It's frustrating.
On that note, I will say you and I have a wonderful way of communicating, and I really appreciated it. And you've been very helpful for me to understand many things that I have not, especially in certain discussions go on emails, and you chime in, and I'm like, ah, now I understand.
Well,
and you know that already, and I appreciate that, and I appreciate that you gave me this interview. It's been fun. And,
well, thank you.
Give you the last word.
I have certainly also appreciated your support in some of those situations, and the more that we can do to support each other in being more accepted by the scientific community, the better off everybody will be, I think.
Agreed. And I look forward to maybe in a year or so come back again after we've got lots of great data and we'll talk again. Thank you, Ellen. I appreciate it very much.
Thank you.